Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg, editor of the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael, and today we're going to talk about alcohol use on campus. With us in the studio today are three guests. Indiana University Dean of Students Richard McKeag is here. The president of the CARES Board in Bloomington, Monroe County, Jennifer Staub, is here. And Indiana University Police Department Operations Captain Keith Cash is with us today. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. Or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Welcome. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here with us. I think many return visitors here today. And a return topic. We can probably talk about alcohol use on campus probably more often than we'd care to. But so what are the expectations for this first weekend that the students are here? Keith?
I would say it's going to be pretty typical of all our previous years, not to be boring, but it's nothing we haven't seen in the past. I mean, about the same even if you go look at our arrest statistics, if you're one of those folks that likes to look at those, they're pretty consistent year after year. So I would say that it's going to be pretty average of some people home away for the first time, chance to party and think they won't get arrested. Some will, some won't. Some will get some hospital runs. And so it's just consistent with what we've dealt with in the past.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dick, do you have any thoughts about this first weekend, and particularly since this is a weekend without classes on Labor Day?
Weekend without classes on Labor Day. Well, I'd like to emphasize the positive things I expect to be happening this weekend, like this afternoon, our students showing up in Assembly Hall in large numbers to celebrate sport at IU, and tomorrow I hope a very large attendance at the football game to cheer on our team. We have a community service day planned on Monday, which will involve lots of students. Keith's right. There will be students who will make mistakes, but out of 38,000 students, my hunch is we'll have a very, very, very small percentage that will make mistakes. But we're focusing on those, I guess, today.
Yeah, and they're the ones we're here to talk about.
Right.
Yeah.
I understand.
That's not really fair, I guess. Jennifer, could you talk a little bit about CARES and what the CARES Board does?
Sure. The CARES Board has been around since 1987, I think. And it coordinates all the justice, treatment, and prevention aspects of the community in regards to alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. There's 21 members, and our whole goal is to reduce the harmful effect in the community, which includes IU.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it is true. I want to go back to what Dick said. It is true that there are a lot of students who are coming into town, and we don't want to paint them all with the same brush or anything of that nature, because there's so many good things that the students bring to campus when they come back. But it is a fact that alcohol use and alcohol abuse is a major concern on college campuses. We just had some stories in the media about the Amethyst Initiative, which is a lot of college presidents trying to look at how to deal with this problem. And I know there was some misreporting of it, at least at first, about how the presidents were – 100 presidents or more had signed on to this, let's reduce the drinking age to 18 from 21, when in fact they said let's open the dialogue, if I recall. Dick, do you think that what good would be done by opening the dialogue to discuss maybe lowering the drinking age, or what other strategies could you see that would help?
Yeah, I think it would be very appropriate to open the dialogue about what we're doing to address abusive drinking by students under the age of 21. In fact, for that matter, of course, all students. I don't know focusing on 21 is as productive as some might hope, because it sort of suggests that there's something about the age that is the most significant cause for the alcohol abuse we face. And in reality, it's a factor, but it's by no means the only factor, and it may not change the problem at all, and it could make the problem worse to reduce it. But there's certainly good reasons to talk about what's happening in alcohol, and there's some reasons to be positive. Jennifer, I'm sure, can tell us about some of the initiatives that have been going on in high schools and grade schools. And there's some data to suggest that the student populations coming to us are less experienced and less alcohol-soaked, if you will, than the generations that have been here before. And so I think progress is being made. The reason we ought to talk about it is if you look at the college data, though, over the last 10 years, all the initiatives that have been undertaken, there haven't been really significant changes in behavior. We have modest improvements in certain areas, but we haven't made significant progress. And quite frankly, the significant progress might come because of initiatives like folks like Jennifer are involved in that are really bringing a new look to alcohol in the age group when they may be most impressionable.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody know historically why 21? Why not 22? Why not 19? How we happen to settle on that number as the drinking age?
I think it must have been related to just the age of majority, and so 21 was reasonable. And there were some states that had a lower age because alcohol was more involved in their culture, and you graduated from high school at 18. And Indiana had been 21 for as long as I can remember, and that's 60-some years. So we didn't go through that change that some states talk about. But it is confusing, I suppose, if we say 18 is the age of majority for this, but for drinking it's that. And then, so there is an inconsistency there. But there's also new research coming out about brain development that might suggest that the age of 21 is more realistic than the arbitrary date 21 that was established several years ago.
Mm-hmm. Bob, growing up in Winchester, did you make that drive over to Ohio? I hope your mom's not listening.
She knows all about it. No, I mean, Dick's point is a good one, because when I was growing up, Ohio had an 18-year-old drinking age for 3-2 beer. Mm-hmm. Michigan, I believe you could drink anything when you were 18 or 19. And then, if I recall, the federal government got together and said, we're going to make it 21 if you want to get these highway funds, right? So, and it seems like a sane thing to do to not have different states, because that just puts people on the highways.
Driving to go get
alcohol, right.
And the data does show, since everything went to 21, that the deaths have gone down. So the data supports it. But there is a lot of inconsistencies, particularly when people say you can go fight for our country, but you can't drink a beer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What about the argument that by isolating kids in a situation where they have to go hide to drink, you're actually doing them a disservice by not making it more of a social having them drink in a social setting where they're surrounded by adults who are actually then kind of tempering the behavior just by their presence there. How do you respond to that argument?
I think it is true that you generally get kids who go drink somewhere else so that they can hide and then drive to get there and drive to come back. And even if the drinking age was back down to 18, we would still experience that at the high school level, which is what I deal with mostly. And I guess in all of this, one of the thoughts that I've had is that nothing in the current law prohibits parents from teaching responsible drinking. So I think that's an interesting part of this, of thinking about, you know, if lowering the age is just really about teaching responsible drinking, right now, that could be a parent role that isn't often talked about. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't right now because of the law teach responsible drinking, but I think it's a piece that it hasn't been talked about very much.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about underage drinking today. Our three guests are Dean of Students Richard McKeag from Indiana University, Jennifer Staub, who's the president of the CARES Board, and Keith Cash, who's Indiana University Police Department's operations captain. If you have questions, please phone us 855-0811, 877-285-9348, and you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Jennifer, what are some of the programs that you have seen be effective in the age group that you work with?
Well, we started 10 years ago getting rid of any drug prevention program that we didn't have research behind it to prove effective. So we switched away from DARE, and Bloomington Police Department was willing to switch with us away from DARE and go to Life Skills, which had lots more research and showed that it truly did change drinking and use habits. And we've seen our own local data that bears out, that we have less drinking and drug use than we had 10 years ago. That doesn't mean that our level is acceptable, and we still are above state and national averages. But we've gone down in greater percentages than state and national averages. And then the other piece, we just recently received an alcohol prevention grant, and I think we got it because we were able to pull out and really target populations. We know our general population uses more than state and national. Then we looked at athletes and we saw they use more than the general population. And then we looked at students who say they miss 10 days of schools. They report using more. And then athletes who miss 10 days or more of school, they should just go straight to treatment. It's close to 70% of those students use on a regular basis. So with that, we were able to then get programming to target each of those groups directly. Mm-hmm. And that makes a bigger difference than just these kind of general statements that you say don't do it.
And to be more specific, when you say use on a regular basis, I mean people that drink every day, drink 3 or 4 times a week?
The definition we use is within 30 days.
Okay.
So we use a 30-day measure. And we can break it down smaller and find out weekly. We can break it down smaller and find out daily. Mm-hmm. And the percentages clearly go down. But we feel like if you're using in the past 30 days,
okay.
And we stay away from spring break as that measure.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And how does life skills differ from DARE? What's the different approach?
DARE used to be, here's the drugs, here's what it does to you, don't do it. Mm-hmm. Life skills doesn't get into the effects. And DARE actually showed in some studies that it increased use. And so life skills talks about how you make decisions, how you figure out your own personal values in relation to your family values, how you resist peer pressure, how you communicate your decisions. So it's really about life skills, decision-making, communicating, and how media influences you and how you can kind of sort through the media messages. Mm-hmm. And less about here's the drugs.
Yeah.
You know, less the Nancy Reagan approach.
Okay. I do know that when some young people that I used to be around a lot, my stepdaughter and some of her mm-hmm. friends, a lot of young people who were probably drinking and using drugs wore those DARE t-shirts. It was just sort of – you could sort of tell that it was kind of
– No comment.
Right.
Right. All right. We have a phone call. Let's go to Bill. Bill?
Hello.
Hello, Bill.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I haven't heard too much in the discussion about the culture of alcohol with students and the culture that promotes drinking. And of particular concern to me is what happens up at – surrounding Memorial Stadium on game day. There's a lot of alumni and parents getting drunk up there and other yahoos, and then they get in their vehicles and they head home after the game. How does the university feel about that? Doesn't that not give conflicting students, signals to students? And also, the university licensing the use of its name, the interlocking insignia, IU, to appear on beer posters. So it's licensing the use of his name to brewery companies. First it was Budweiser, and now it is Miller Lite. And you see those in convenience stores, in student bars, particularly the Kilroy's bars, and all liquor stores. I'd like to hear you comment on that, either one of you. I asked President McRobbie about that, and he said he wasn't even aware that was going on. I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Okay, Bill. Thanks a lot. Good questions.
Good questions, and I frankly agree with the caller and probably have a string of memos that have issued during my time as dean to suggest that there are real issues here. There is no question the culture of alcohol contributes to the alcohol abuse in the age group that are in college. In fact, any realistic policy to try and – or approach to try and reduce alcohol has to start with the whole culture. And usually people – that was one of my comments about why discussing just the drinking age probably isn't the issue because it's that culture that creates the anticipation that when you get to college, that's what you do. We have a survey of students that was last spring that asked them to what extent does the culture of alcohol at IU how much does IU student culture encourage irresponsible alcohol consumption? And some folks will probably be shocked to see that about 50% of our students say, yeah, there is an irresponsible culture about alcohol. We need to find ways to kind of capture that student energy. I'm just not reading a study now that came out today that talks about the percentage of students who think there's nothing you can do about it, obviously a pretty hardcore drinking crowd if you look at their use of alcohol, the percentage that think they're – which is a rather large group that thinks you could do something about it, and we need to capture that group to help us. But it's not only drinking at the stadium. It's the number of bars in a community. It's the number of ads in a newspaper about alcohol. And the minute I say that, someone will remind me about free press. Our culture – I think it's estimated that about 11% – of the alcohol industry profit comes from underage drinking. So we have a legal business interest that is making a percentage of its profit off of illegal use. And so the alcohol culture is a significant concern. And usually when I approach any element of the culture to raise the question, they will say, well, I understand your point, but making a change here won't really solve the problem. And in that sense, they're right. It won't solve the problem. But of course, they all use that to me, and I have 10 conversations, and if the 10 of them together would take the step forward, we might make a change. But they each individually tell me, well, you know, we're being competitive with other schools, and we have to make an attractive game day environment. And of course, it is legal for those of age to drink, and one of the ways that we're able to support a vast sport program is to realistically deal with individuals that market the sports program. And the litany of excuses, and I have them from the newspapers, and I have them from the bar owners in town, are all logical, reasonable statements. A nice, broad dialogue about this issue would be very helpful because we all are contribute to the alcohol culture.
Yeah, if I could just comment sure. also. And echoing some of what Dick said, it's not unique to here. Our brother and sister universities of like size, we speak with all the time, and it's certainly not unique here. It's not unique when you get to any sports culture, professional football, et cetera, and that's one of the arguments. But I would at least tell the caller that it is not like we turn a blind eye. When I go talk to student groups, I'm very candid with them. I said, I know there's large numbers there, and you look like you can get lost in the crowd, but that's not really accurate. We do heavy enforcement in that little postage size stamp of land that if you're going to be there underage, you're probably going to get caught and be arrested. So most of the ones we arrest, it's usually they're either under 21, but a large part of people that are the legal drinking age, and they're just there partying.
Mm-hmm. What kind of enforcement force is there around Memorial Stadium on game days?
Well, every one of our officers are working. In addition, we use Bloomington City Police Officers, Indiana State Police Officers, and Monroe County Sheriff's Department. Excise Police, which does alcohol enforcement solely, are typically in plain clothes, and they're wandering throughout that – what would you want to call it – the tailgating lot. They're there. We have roaming teams of officers as soon as the gates open that are doing nothing but going through in uniform and enforcing, make sure people are of age and that nobody's too intoxicated. Because if you don't do it early, you have a crowd of 25 that turns into 50, that turns into 200, and you throw a football and hit somebody else and the fight's on. So we hit it pretty hard, and there's a good number of officers in there mm-hmm. policing it.
Yeah. How obnoxious do you have to get in order to – seriously. in order to get to, you know, targeted.
It's going to be somebody that you can just you know, all our officers are well trained, and we get a lot of our equipment thankfully through CARES Board, like PBTs and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But we do training with alcohol with all our officers, so they know the signs to look for. And it's not the one who's just sitting there bothering no one. It's someone who's truly drawing attention to themselves.
Now, what if an under 21-year-old person is drinking with their parents under their parents' supervision? Are they still? Can you still arrest them?
A good question, and it is an awkward scenario, and I think it gets back to what we were talking about with folks educating. But usually our officers are looking for not just a mom and dad and a kid. I mean it's mm-hmm. usually, like I said, something larger. But I do know excise has gone up and cited a mom and a dad and a kid, and it was just the scenario you described. It is still against the law. I'm not saying, you know, personally agree with it or not, but yeah, they can still be cited regardless. We've had parents that have left beer in their dorm room for their kid, even though they weren't 21. So, I mean, it's I guess, a parent choice.
Hmm. You know, Bill brought up two different points, and Dick, you really addressed both of them, but we've been talking mostly about the culture and the scenario on campus. But I was surprised when I walked into Chili's, actually, you know, sort of a family place, and I saw pennants around the bar that had light beer and Indiana University, the trademarked symbol of IU. And maybe I've been just naive and missed this over the years, but that seemed new. Is it new to have the IU logo licensed to beer company?
I don't know that it's new this year. I at least 2 years ago wrote a memo on it, and it's my understanding it happens in relationship to a outside firm that has marketing rights for intercollegiate sports radio and television events. I believe it's called Learfield Sports if they're still the contractor. And it's part of their sports promotion package, which they have rights to do given their contract. Mm-hmm. Again, it's an issue that
– But the university has to sign the contract with
Learfield. That's mm-hmm. correct.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that just seemed a little odd to me.
We had an email that came in. It says, why does the problem of alcohol abuse in college seem to involve white students more than non-white students? Dick, that'd probably be you. Maybe you
can. Yeah. I was somewhere in front of me is data that talks about that. I don't know precisely that I have a good explanation.
Is the assumption true?
The assumption is not 100% true. The data I can't find my hands on right now has to do with it breaks down each of the races, and it's not true if you're looking at each of the races. But I don't know if it's an economic issue, if it's a family background issue. The presumption that there's no drinking in certain minority communities would absolutely be false. But I don't know that I have a good explanation other than possibly peer pressure and peer expectations. And that's, of course, what we would want to activate across other groups too.
Mm-hmm. All right. The phone numbers again, 855-0811, 877-285-9348, and noon@indiana.edu. Following up on that, and I know that the stereotype would probably be that fraternities are places where a lot of drinking goes on, and possibly sorority houses, a lot of drinking goes on. I know you've had a lot of efforts to try to work with fraternities and sororities. How are those efforts working?
Well, I think we've made some progress in sorority houses, quite frankly. I think I could say pretty with certainty that there are no alcohol events in a sorority house. The party atmosphere is in the fraternity house. Now, that's not to suggest that every sorority woman on our campus in the privacy of her own room observes Indiana University regulations. I'm not that naive. But in terms of the big events, no, they're not in sorority houses. The progress with fraternities has been good. I think some in the community would want to remind me very quickly that our efforts have moved alcohol as opposed to eliminating alcohol use. And we're certainly aware of that and work with the city police also to try address those issues. The solution isn't, of course, in my mind, for us to ignore it so that there's more. The solution is for both of us to address it together. Many of our men's fraternities in reorganizing in the past few years because they've been closed by the university or the national organization have come back with a commitment of no alcohol in the house. They are very serious about that. They are some of our best organizations. Several national organizations have made efforts in those directions. Others have made efforts to simply say we'll observe the university regulations, but we will absolutely require the law be enforced. And so I think we are making some progress. But if you look at my data, you would see that indeed members of fraternities and sororities drink at greater quantity than do non-members. And again, it's a reinforcement of that culture. It's a culture thing that creates an environment and an expectation which people live down to, I guess would be the way to say it.
Are the fraternity – I know that there was some time in the past when fraternities were renting houses off campus to use for parties. Is that still happening?
Well, technically the technical answer would be no, it doesn't happen and it didn't happen then because fraternities a fraternity house is owned by a house corporation legally registered in the state of Indiana, and I can assure you that house corporation is not renting property off campus.
Right.
Five seniors who are moving out of the house are living in the same house, and I think that continues to happen. And in that sense, our data on where students drink, the majority of students drink in bars in Bloomington. The second highest frequency of drinking is apartments off campus. Then you get to the campus environments. And part of that, of course, has to do with the supervision that goes on in our residence halls and the supervision that still exists at a different level in our fraternity houses. In terms of fraternity houses off campus, technically there are not fraternity houses off campus. You have students who are living in houses who are also members of fraternities. In that sense, I suppose you could say there are Democrats off campus that have parties and there are Republicans off campus that have parties.
I'm sure that's true. Yeah. Probably journalists off campus.
Journalists off campus. College of Arts and Science majors.
That's right. All right. I think it's a good time for us to take a break. I'm anticipating a lot of calls and a lot of emails in the second half of our program. We're talking about underage alcohol use. Our guests today are Richard McKeag, the Dean of Students at IU, Jennifer Staub, who's the President of the CARES Board, and Captain Keith Cash, who's with the Indiana University Police Department. You're listening to Noon Edition. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home office and garage, using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2 owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. And from South Dunn Street Project, represented by Brian Lappin Real Estate, classic bungalow-inspired architecture in the Bryan Park neighborhood of Bloomington, www.southdunnstreet.info. If you're a person on the go, you can take WFIU programs with you. We're podcasting. Podcasting is a convenient and easy way to download audio files directly to your computer. Listen anytime from your computer, iPod, or portable player. You can download podcasts of full-length programs like Noon Edition, Ask the Mayor, and Harmonia, or short features like Kinsey Confidential, the Ether Game musical mini-quiz, and movie, play, and opera reviews. You can find out how with a visit to our website at wfiu.org.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Salzberg from the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael, and we're talking today about the use of alcohol among young people. Indiana University Dean of Students Richard McKagg is our guest, along with the president of the CARES Board, Jennifer Staub, and Indiana University Police Department Operations Captain Keith Cash. Mary Catherine Carmichael is here. We were laughing during the break about something. So you caught us. We came back too early. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348, and you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. Keith, you were talking about your dealings with the fraternity houses.
A number of years back, we had not a real good working relation. That's something I wanted to change. And so I started meeting with them and basically wanted to have very candid conversations. You know, I told them I'd treat them as adults and I may give them answers they don't want to hear, but at least be respectful and listen to the answer, and we could agree to disagree. And it's worked out really well. It's not to say that there's less partying, but I think they are very responsive. When we mentioned like there's binge drinking the first week of school and there were a couple ambulance runs, they all met, got together. And I'm not saying they said we're not going to all drink, but those numbers immediately went down. So I think they are a responsive group trying to do the right thing, knowing that they're in, like Dick said, the culture of that's one of the things you know you do in a fraternity. But they made – some of the candid arguments they made were some of the ones we mentioned earlier is that you're pushing it elsewhere. And I'm not saying this is to condone that you drink in a fraternity, and Dick would probably – I have comments about that as well, but it is. I mean, they made some very good arguments, like I said, and I think they are trying to be responsible.
Well, what about the argument from citizens who say, you know, I'd rather they were drinking at the fraternity or, you know, somewhere else on campus because then they're already among their peers and they're, you know, they can pretty much walk to wherever they need to be in order to interact with their peers and you know, that's kind of what it's all about anyway. And so – you know, let's just say, okay, this is a safe environment. Let's keep you safe. Let's keep you in one place.
Well, it's frankly not that safe. I'm sad to say that at Indiana University we've had student deaths related to drinking in a fraternity house, and nationally, of course, there have been. It's not that safe because drinking in a fraternity house doesn't mean you don't get on the road late at night to go to White Castle, or it doesn't mean you don't run out of beer and decide to get on the road. It doesn't mean that somebody doesn't decide to move the party. To address the culture, we need to address the alcohol abuse wherever it is, and we have to acknowledge that sometimes even our best intent has unintended consequences, and then we have to be prepared to deal with those.
It's kind of like squeezing a balloon.
Yes.
And by definition, everybody in fraternity house, not everybody will be over 21.
That's correct. That's correct. And many of our fraternity houses, the number of seniors living in is relatively small right now.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have a phone call. Andy is next. Andy?
Hello.
Hi, Andy.
I went to the University of Buffalo in 1954 and got involved in going down the street to Brunner's Cafe and singing, drinking songs and getting drunk and going to fraternity parties, which they had in big halls. You know, they'd rent a hall, an American Legion Hall, and have a big dance and party. And one time they even had a bathtub they filled with. Your entrance was a requirement was a bottle of vodka or gin and a bottle of grape juice. They called it Purple Jesus. So people got drunk a lot. But the thing I noticed was that people who were 16 and 17 thought it was a real big thrill to have somebody buy a six-pack for them so they could drink early, you know? And when I got to Indiana University, I found an entirely different situation. By the way, I visited Cornell University, and they have drinking on campus. You know, beer is available in the cafeteria. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. And people weren't as thrilled about drinking when it was available all the time. And I got to Indiana University and was amazed to find people 20 years old having a big thrill, having somebody buy them a six-pack of beer so they could drink illegally. And it seems like what they do by having a drinking age 21 instead of 18 is they extend the immaturity 3 years. It's kind of an interesting point. And so this immaturity, people get all excited, I can have some beer, you know, if I get it illegally. But when they get legal, they lose interest. So would you comment about that, please?
All right, Andy. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
It's interesting. I began my career working in Wisconsin, and when I was in Wisconsin, the drinking age was 18. And the one thing that it does allow you to do is change the dialogue to alcohol abuse from illegal use, at least in the college environment. The high school issue then that Jennifer suggested becomes a real issue too. But it is true that there was abusive drinking in Wisconsin when I was there, but we were working with a peer culture that was more willing to address abusive drinking because nobody, of course, abusively drinks. Even the alcoholic will tend to say he doesn't drink any more than anyone else. So the issue becomes those students who, as long as they think you're not taking their beer away, might be willing to engage in a conversation about abusive drinking and ways to stop abusive drinking and creating a culture that sends negative messages. College cultures now and student cultures in general tend to make fun about. Remember that night that I got, or the writing on the body while the person's passed out? All of those cultural things that go on seem to encourage underage abusive drinking. So the caller's right. It certainly that is a potential advantage. There are many, many other issues that should come into it, but certainly that's a part of it. And the latest study I've seen, which again won't surprise the caller, students under the age of 21 drink less often in increased quantities once they turn 21. Frankly, they drink more often more frequently for a period of time, but in lesser quantities.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read a story this week. I think it might be a new survey about the 21st birthday and the amount of drinking that goes on a 21st birthday. And I think this story I read, if I remember right, I think it was in USA Today, talked about how in the survey the average number of drinks of a person turning 21 was 12 among males and 9 among females on a 21st birthday, which seemed exorbitant to me. Is that an experience that you think is consistent through Indiana?
Well, it's certainly something I hear about. You'll find some of our bars in town who are very much concerned about that and will take special care to identify who's 21, and the person being identified probably feels it is out of a sense of customer appreciation, but it's also liability protection because they're paying very close attention to that individual who might have reasons in their culture to drink more than they should. At the same time, we've had an educational program, and again, this may sound insignificant, but I'm trying to ask people to think in the cultural sense of sending happy birthday cards to people who are about to turn 21, reminding them to be careful and giving them some information about alcohol and alcohol abuse. So it is a part of the culture.
It's pretty hard when you're invincible to get through to people who are invincible.
Yeah. I want to follow up on what Dick said. One of the things that CARES has funded before for IU is little cards that they hand out that are signs of alcohol poisoning.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got one side has the signs on it, and the other side it has, what do you do? Because I know the hospital has experienced pulling up and dropping them off and running. And we've talked with the emergency department before about the increased levels of visits they get there, particularly in the weekend before school starts, which would be this weekend. And then they also hand out things right before spring break because that's the other mm-hmm. peak time. And then Little 500. Those are the three big times for alcohol abuse. But the 21st birthday would be the one that follows, you know, in timing with the individual.
Mm-hmm. What are the signs of alcohol poisoning?
Well, I don't have my little card right in front of me. Unconscious.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, unconscious.
Dick's going to – he's reaching for something there.
He's got one on.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I usually carry it with me.
No, I just have always wondered, you know.
Well, oh, there it is.
Now I have to slide my glasses down to show.
Yeah.
That's not sure.
That's not Let's see. Signs of alcohol poisoning, how to help a friend. Try to wake your friend, and if your friend does not respond, there may be a serious problem. Listen to your friend's breathing. Is it irregular, too slow or shallow? And check your friend's skin. Is his or her skin pale or blushed, or is it cold and clammy? If any of those occur, take action. Dial 911. Stay with your friend while waiting, and make sure your friend is lying on his side to prevent choking.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of alcohol abuse like that for alcohol poisoning, other related issues. I mean, drinking to excess can cause you to die. I mean, we know that. Dick mentioned that earlier. But then there are all sorts of related activities that come along with drinking that are other good reasons not to, to become out of control. Keith, you want to talk about?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, because obviously we really don't, despite what some students think, we don't go out of our way to look for somebody who's just underage drinking and doing nothing else. It's pretty much attention is drawn to individuals. And a whole host of them. Some of them are vandalisms, criminal mischief. You know, somebody's walking home drunk and they decide they have to rip a sign out of the ground for no reason but to carry it around. And so these things draw attention, you know, to that individual. So we have more vandalisms, more batteries, and those are pretty much associated with the excessive drinking.
Let me just quote some national statistics from the CORE survey. And some of them, everybody's going to say, yeah, that's funny, isn't it? I had a hangover, 62%. Got nauseated or vomited, 58%. Been criticized by someone I know, 30%. Now let's get into the more serious stuff. Been arrested for DWI, about 2%. Been sexually taken advantage of, 10%. Tried to commit suicide, 1.1%. Seriously thought about suicide, 4%. These, of course, are self-reported information on the National CORE survey. But the fact of the matter is there are serious consequences that are related to alcohol abuse. And if you look at our judicial cases on campus, those incidents involving fights will once in a while not have involved alcohol. But 90% of the time, alcohol was involved.
And I would imagine the same is true of rape or sexual battery of some kind. Has that been your experience, Keith?
Yeah, and most and just for our definition of the ones we respond to, most of our reported sexual assaults and rapes are usually acquaintance. And you're right. It almost always have involved alcohol, some form of drinking by one or both parties.
Mm-hmm. And Jennifer, you want to respond to that as well, because I know you've done a lot of work in this area.
In the sex area?
Yeah. Well, sex and alcohol. Right.
One of the things that we talk to students about is that generally – the first time you have sex, you don't wake up that morning thinking, I think today's the day I'm going to have sex. Mm-hmm. Usually it's a period – it's a several smaller decisions that lead up to that point. And generally, one of the decisions earlier on is going to party and drinking. So almost always the individual says they didn't plan on having sex, that it was – it happened after a result of several little bad decisions coming together.
It just happened.
Yeah.
Last year we talked a lot about a new program that freshmen were being required to participate in. It was about a 3-hour online course that they had to take before they enrolled in the university. Alcohol EDU is the company name. And generally, I'm sure we had at least two or three student newspaper reports about it being a boring program. And quite honestly, no single 3-hour program at the computer is going to change the world with regard to our student use of alcohol. But our follow-up data does show there was a slight increase in students of both genders who on average thought about their blood alcohol content or who choose to drink alcohol beverages containing a lower alcohol concentration. Knowledge pertaining to the impact of alcohol use and risk reduction increased for both men and women. Women increased their knowledge about BAC and physiological effects of alcohol. And there's several others. Males reported a slight increase in intention to choose a drink containing lower alcohol concentration and set personal limits on how much they would drink. Mm-hmm. Now, all of this sounds silly to be talking about because those were freshmen, which means they weren't supposed to be drinking at all because they're probably all under 21. But if you really are interested in changing the culture, this is the kind of thing you get involved in.
Right. And I want to ask Jennifer about that too, because you deal a lot with high school age kids. But first, I want to go to the phone because we have a call. Paul, go ahead.
Okay. One reason to keep a low profile is because the police will notice that you're drunk, right? But another reason to keep a low profile and not get involved in road rage is because even though you're excitable and angry when you're drunk, it is the case that 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 15 Hoosiers is licensed to carry a concealed weapon. And if you should practice road rage on those people, you might find yourself being treated as a very bad person. If you were pounding on somebody's window yelling, "I'll beat you up, I'll kill you," you could get a bullet through your head. So I just thought I'd mention that. It should be noticed that people do carry weapons, and people should not practice road rage on those people.
Keith?
That's correct. I would say, though, most of our road rage incidents, very few of them involve alcohol. It's usually people who just have anger management issues. But yeah, still duly noted, yeah. People do carry weapons.
But you were talking about people who are walking home and are involved in vandalism, I assume. Because I know we sometimes at the newspaper will get a call from somebody saying, "Hey, I was just walking home. I had way too much to drink, so I didn't want to drive. But I'm walking home, and I still get stopped.
Yeah.
You know, I should have just gotten in my car. Maybe I would have made it." But your point is that if somebody's really drunk walking home, they can do a lot of other stupid things.
That's correct. And I talked to a lot of groups, and it's interesting. Most of the groups, there will always be somebody that knows somebody that was doing absolutely nothing. And usually we go pull a case, and we meet weekly with the dean of students, and he can verify that, no, the person just wasn't merely walking home. One of the examples I give, since we were talking about bars, is I asked people in the audience, I said, "How many bars are in Bloomington roughly?" And they guess. And I said, "How many of you been to those bars?" And they'll tell me. "How many people does that bar hold?" And I said, "If you had to give a percentage of how many people you thought were truly drunk, above a 0.10, not even just above a 0.08, and they'll usually say, "It's a pretty high number." I said, so you're saying there could be even thousands? And they're like, "Oh, yeah." I said, "If you look at the police blotter, are we arresting thousands of people?" Absolutely not. We don't have time. These are truly people that are doing something that has drawn our attention.
Mm-hmm. All right. I wanted to go back to Jennifer just to talk about Dick was talking about some progress being made on the surveys that he's seen. And I know you mentioned that you're seeing some progress being made with underage drinking from a lot of the work that you've been doing. Talk about, again, some of the programs with high school kids and what you're seeing in terms of trends.
Well, when we do follow our data and look at it, and we do the data from 6th grade through 12th grade every other year and watch how that progresses. And 10 years ago, we were above state and national averages on absolutely everything at every grade level. We have seen a shift in recent years that our 6th through 8th are below state and national averages on everything, but our high schoolers are not. The two that we're above on are alcohol consumption, and then specifically binge drinking, and then marijuana use. So those are the three. We have seen them go down. Before, our monthly use of alcohol for a 12th grader used to be 58%. Now we're down to 49%. And one of the things that we try to get across in messages to students is that it's really not the norm. It feels like it's the norm that everyone drinks, but it's really not the norm. And if 49%, granted, it's 1% difference from average. But most students don't drink on a regular basis. And that's the message that we try to convey. And that's but you don't on the Monday after hear from the students who didn't drink. On the Monday after, you hear from the students talking about the parties that they went to. And so that's what feels like, God, everybody's drinking. And so it becomes this feeling of, to be accepted into the group, that I need to participate in that behavior too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk a little bit about the 6th to 8th grade numbers.
Well, we think that's because as a community, not just the life skills curriculum, but as a community, there has been a lot of effort on addressing that population. We know that at the end of the 8th grade year, that makes a big difference. And if you delay the onset of any kind of use, then hopefully you're going to delay the onset of any kind of damage or injury or harmful effects. And so we know life skills has been in place for 6th, 7th, and 8th, and we know that other after-school initiatives and other programs around the community, in the schools and out in the agencies and in churches, have been in place for that group. And we've tried to work more with parents at that level too. So I think that it's been a lot of effort to address that group. But I think once you hit high school, particularly driving age, it opens up the doors. And we've talked about the culture in this town. Our community, because the university has a high tolerance of alcohol use and abuse, and our students are not immune to that. It's a direct effect. A lot of our students have older siblings, older friends who have houses on campus, make it easy. There's just alcohol more readily available for our high school age students.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about access to alcohol, working with liquor stores, working with bars, working even with grocery stores, any place that sells beer. What kind of efforts do you make along those lines to make sure that the people who are selling alcohol are selling it to people who are legally able to buy it?
Well, from an enforcement side, I would defer more towards excise police. That's really their focus, and they do. They're very aggressive. They do a good job. We do work with them, and I do know they police on a regular basis the bars, the liquor stores, grocery, all of them, just the ones you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Our department does not, because we don't really typically have any bars, grocery stores in our jurisdiction. Uh-huh. But excise police does, and they share any information with us that we need to know. So I don't think anybody turns a blind eye to those establishments, and they have liquor licenses they don't want to lose, and, mm-hmm. and they get heavy fines. So, and if I'm not mistaken, I think there may even be not only will the individual lose their liquor license, but I think they can even be subject to a criminal penalty now if they're the one who has sold it to a buddy or whatever.
Uh-huh. All right, we have a phone call. It's Lois next. Lois.
Hi. I just wanted to weigh in on the age of drinking legally. I graduated from IU as an undergraduate many years ago, and I went to Ohio State where the drinking age was 18 at the time. And the amount of vandalism and violence that occurred, the fighting, just blew me away. I was, you know, because there were so many younger people and more people drinking, I would really think it's a bad idea to lower the drinking age.
Okay. We appreciate the call. We've talked about that issue just a little bit, but we appreciate your weighing in. We have another call, and it's Bill this time. Bill?
Hello there. I've been listening to your discussion, and as a mental health and addiction therapist for many years, I have some comments. What I observed, I worked in Illinois for many years, and but these kids start so young, age 10, they start on the pot, a lot of them, and then it is still a gateway drug, although people like to argue the point. And now what I've observed in Illinois, I don't know if this is true in Indiana, that these kids now are into polysubstance abuse. They are not just using pot, alcohol. They move around, the pills, whatever is available. And so it is a very serious time for our young people. I don't think there should be any drinking on campus, and I think it should be tight. I think perhaps making students who violate go to some Al-Anon AA classes, maybe even into the jail and see some of these people and the residual effects. And you see some pretty sad sights that might frighten them. But intensive education is needed. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. Dick, I see you nodding your head.
Well, I agree with the caller. The multi-substance use is an issue that we run into. And, in fact, on our campus, any student who is arrested or written up in our residence halls is first given the opportunity to participate in our alternative alcohol intervention program, which is an assessment and counseling-based program to look at their alcohol use, patterns of alcohol use, family history, to try and help reorient them to think about alcohol and also think about the reason they're at Indiana University. And, of course, the county has its own Monroe County substance abuse efforts that go on that Jennifer probably could tell you about out of the prosecutor's office, where there's a comparable opportunity for students who have been arrested.
Mm-hmm. I can't speak necessarily to the prosecutor-specific program, but I think the thing that CARES is great about is that it pulls everybody together on a common page so that it's not just IU looking at their problems and the schools looking at theirs and the prosecutor looking at theirs. Everyone's working together towards some common goals. And what I didn't mention earlier is that the CARES Board receives annually, it's around $100,000 a year, sometimes more, sometimes less, that comes in from drunk driver fees. Then in turn, we use that kind of our priorities and distribute the money across the board. And that's some of the things that Keith had mentioned earlier, is that we fund oftentimes portable breath tests and life skills workbooks and other things to help prevent the problem.
I imagine listening today, we have some parents who are in town after having dropped off their children here at IU and hopefully sticking around and enjoying Bloomington a little bit. What kind of advice do you give to parents who are concerned about binge drinking or you know, just drinking to excess on campus? What do you tell them to tell their kids?
Well, the real issue is the value system of the young student, their ability to withstand peer pressure. And so we encourage parents to talk with their kids. Talk with their kids about family values. Talk with their kids about expectations with regard to alcohol. Talk with their kids about being safe and making safe decisions. Young people are going to experiment, and so there is no magic bullet, of course. But if at least there's some open dialogue, then maybe you don't have the real surprise. The previous caller mentioned early drinking, and of course, the students that tend to have the most serious problems on campus were also those students who started drinking at an earlier age. Mm-hmm. They are more into the alcohol culture when they get here, and they find it more readily available. 70-some percent of our students, I think it's 72%, have consumed alcohol before they arrive at IU. Mm-hmm. Those who started consuming alcohol in the 10th grade, or I should say at 10 or 11 years old, are more likely those that end up at Keith's attention because they've had so much to drink, they end up being taken to the hospital and police have to help them wherever they are around mm-hmm. campus. So with parents, I think the thing you can do is talk with them about your values, your expectations, and encourage open and honest dialogue.
Jennifer, what age – you mentioned in the schools that you're already starting to talk about it pretty early, elementary school.
Right. We start with life skills at sixth grade, but we do, through just our regular health curriculum, address issues early on. As a matter of fact, as early as kindergarten, we have in there that you don't ever touch anybody's medicine and that you don't take something that looks like candy from somebody's hand because an M&M could look like an Advil. And so there's pieces in our curriculum as early as kindergarten and first grade to address some of those. And then so as they get older, then obviously the message gets harder and more concentrated. And sixth grade is where we hit it the heaviest through seventh, eighth, and then again 10th grade.
You know, one other thing I happen to think of, parents might also want to be honest with their kids about Aunt so-and-so and her problem. Occasionally when we deal with – there are genetic dispositions mm-hmm. towards certain problems, and alcoholism is one of them. And occasionally we will find families where there's a history of alcoholism, but the student didn't really recognize the history of alcoholism or didn't even talk about it with his parents until he was in jail actually and the parents were here for some things. And then they begin to acknowledge that, well, you remember we never talked much about Uncle so-and-so. Mm-hmm. So that maybe being honest about the bad effects it's already had on their family could be helpful.
I think along with that, there are other mental illnesses like depression and bipolar depression that students can come here. They can function quite well, but if they have a parent who has something like that, that can also lead to something like more binge drinking, more excessive behavior.
Self-medicating. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Keith, in the last 30 seconds, any message for our listeners out there?
No, just I guess if you do choose to drink, I would say do so responsibly. Otherwise, we'll end up finding you somewhere.
All right. I want to thank our guests today, Dick McKeag, who's the Dean of Students at IU, Jennifer Staub, who's the President of the CARES Board, and Captain Keith Cash from the Indiana University Police Department. For Mary Catherine Carmichael, producer Ariana Prothero, and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.